strength from the enemy invading your very body. We must live. We live in our city we have built with our hands. In our streets, we bear freedom's music through dense smoke, through the rubble of traffic, through unemployment, hunger, and corporate power, widening its poisonous sinews around our limbs. The iron gates of the factory of death are locked on us. Mother and daughter bombs are made within our city. The dead from these lie in our hearts. The children penetrated by bombs made in our city become our own children. The dead enter our streets, accusing in an eerie light. Let us lay it on the steps of the city hall. Our children move into the image of the children of the earth, the refugees, the homeless, the fleeing mothers, the starving. The city darkens with the world darkness. We must live. We must hammer faster, carve our strength, cry out, march in the streets, our arms raised with our common faith and need. Chanting, gathering together, rising from despair, exposing the plunderers. We must find where the song is to be sung. We are on time and together, our anguish in solidarity. We must sing our song together. Abreast we are coming on the wide human road. Leaping, rising against the marauder, they would seize our love and our labor. Should your hours be harsh and solitary, remember in remembering love, our meetings, our labor, our love. Remember this land is ours, our labor is ours, our seed is strong, we are all arriving together. Blood spills on the plowed earth, though the crowds scream overhead, worms unite against the deadly chemicals. Underground rock stained with blood moves to the surface. We move into global visibility. The human face rises out of nuclear menace, rises to assemblage, rises to global light, interlocking, interpenetrating. Global love does not come visiting. Love is forged, and we are forging it. Let us carry our banners of peace through the streets of our city. We stand alive, a hurricane of people. A hurricane of terrible and beautiful force. Hurricane of the terrible breath we have been breathing. Look and see each other massed around the green earth. Remember, we are together, steady. It comes like this, the song. The gentle giant hum of earth and his sons and daughters are not in canisters of bombs. Seek and find each other in the root dark. In the prairie night, long ago written on a buffalo hide of what we were and are, of treaties we have to honor. Listen, listen to those treaties. Look at them, carrying gold in one hand and the bomb in the other, with cluster bombs made to strike the exact height of the target. What hatred, what greed to put one's sacred labor with one's children playing baseball full of vitamins. You have now ghostly children who will wait at your door in the evening with these glass pellets inside them, undiscoverable. You could light our city with new images and wonders, not to explode your own children. But if you arm, if you threaten the nuclear destruction, the bombing annihilation of the earth, if you threaten our people with extermination, if you make your vulture stations of war in all our lands, if you exploit and degrade our flesh, slaughter our bodies and kill our songs of peace, we will emerge from the last mound to fire upon you. We will emerge from the deepest grotto to stab you with thorns. We will emerge from the furrows so the seed will smash and poison you. We will emerge to deny you bread and water. We will emerge. Don't steal our green earth, pollute our waters, poison our flesh. Every mountain will turn into flame, and great tides will rise and batter your shores, and we will thwart and harass and stop you at the meadow of skulls. Don't trash our work and pit our labor against our brothers and sisters for cheap sweatshops over the earth. On the flesh you are buying and the blood you are shedding will rise up against you. Don't. Don't invade countries struggling for their freedom from greedy invaders and thieves of their earth. Our workers, miners, pickers of coffee will be everywhere with eyes and fists waiting for you, with bottles of petroleum in one hand and a guitar in the other. Do not enter Nicaragua or Cuba or arm their enemies, for the workers roused keep all wounds alive, appearing as warriors, and the forests will swallow you and the prairies engulf you. The heads of Puerto Ricans and Filipinos, the hands, and the islands of the Caribbean people will spear awaiting you as the land. Do not advance on the partisan lands. Do not arm the countries of Europe against us. Women will form a solid wave of bodies miles long, and breasts of women, the rifles of Zapata, are not sleeping. Do not disembark on any of the lands of the Indians to exploit and kill them. Assembling are the fighters who have astonished the earth and will light it with their heart fire of the flesh, and they will stop the release of the atom toward the cities of the earth. They will emit from their beings a light greater than the atomic explosion. They will live. O streets, grieving streets, wake, join us. The wounded rise. I think this is my theme for the girl and for the struggle of women. I think this is the great thing that's occurring in our culture, that the cultures of women, of Indians, of Cubans, is becoming visible. It's so great because it becomes visible in our lives. Early in my life, when I was 14, joined the wounded. I didn't join them. I was thrust into them. I was wounded. When I was 14, I went to cover the massacre at Ludlow for the Kansas City Labor paper. I saw that the real cultural and creative life of the Middle West, of our people, was in the dispossessed, was in the wounded, was the consciousness of a creative life was only in the oppressed. And now, what's happening now shows to me that this is even more true. It's only the oppressed who can struggle against the bomb. It's only the oppressed who have nothing to lose that can become the great warriors of our time. And you might say that I'm more conscious of this in relation to women, because women in my time had no voice, I began to write because my grandmother couldn't talk. My grandmother had no way to tell her life. And she hated me starting to write. She said, I've spent all my life trying to conceal what happened to me, how awful it was. Now you're going to tell it. I said, yes, I am, if I can find out about it. Women didn't talk about it. I went around with the first person, I think, with a tape recorder. Sing Out in 1955 gave me a tape recorder and told me to come back to the Middle West and tape the farmers and women. This tape recorder weighed 35 pounds. And I had to carry it. I thought people were going to die, and they were, before I got there. I now have over 200 tapes in my daughter's basement, which are interviews with leaders, farmers, women. They're they're just absolutely for the future historians. A wonderful thing, because nobody was recording them. And I carried that damn thing around, 30 pounds of this tape recorder. Before a person died, I was sitting on the edge of the grave, when they got there. Because these people never had been recorded, never had talked. So my inscription to the girl is from Jeremiah. Oh, that my head was water and mine eyes a flood of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughters of my people. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician? Is not the health of the daughters of my people recovered? They are broken with a great breath, with a grievous blow. Though the land be wounded, they groan. The harvest is past, and the summers is ended, and we are not saved. The land is desolate because of the presence of the oppressor, for the hurt of the daughters of my people, I am hurt. I have to give you just a little background about writing about these women. It's assumed that you were an outsider who suddenly decided you would write about the women in the Depression. Well, that assumption was no good in the Depression because writers were starving, too. I mean, there was no objective class of artists or writers who were outside recording these things. I was starving. The WPA, you people are all born so late, you don't remember these things, but the Writers' Project, for example, and the Artists' Project and the Theater Project, this was the first time where I think a people's culture had been nourished in America. You didn't have to be anything on the Writers' Project but be hungry. And you got $90 a month. And in those times, $90 paid your rent and your food. The first time I ever in my life had time to write without worrying about if I was going to starve to death. And besides that, it was a collective. We wrote together. We had projects together. You didn't just sit in a room, you know, with all of your terrible suffering and write about, you know, how you couldn't fall in love or betrayal of a lover, like much of our poetry is. You wrote with others. We made a history of every county in Minnesota, for example. We made interviews with people, speeches of different ethnic groups were recorded. This was the first time there was really a true people's history organized and told. These writers' manuals, these writers' guides, they're still good guides. If you just change, put in the highways and the freeways, they're the first labor history and people's history was written in those guides. They're still wonderful to look at, to read. They should be reprinted, all of them. So there was this whole thing in the Depression of being thrown with others. It's nothing like being hungry with others to give you solidarity. Hunger is the greatest organizer in the world. General hunger, I call him. And we were all brought together, even esoteric writers, a person like Sinclair Lewis and Scott Fitzgerald would not have been such sick people if they could have ever written with other people. I mean, you know, they turned out to be ill, sick, lonely people. So much of the material and all the experiences, you don't realize that in the 30s, the cities were inundated by women, farm women. And you don't realize that there was absolutely no way to feed these women. There was no social organizations like we have now. There was no free food. You could starve to death in a week. You could lose your job. You could lose your house. There was no mortgage moratorium. You could lose your house if you didn't pay one month's mortgage payment. So, and we had nothing to take the brunt of this unemployment. And women especially, there was no food lines for women. There were food lines for men. And it wasn't that women couldn't get in the food line, but you'd be made fun of, propositioned, and all these men were in the... There was no way... Women just lived off of the alleys and what you could get. And then they started a terrible thing, sterilization of women, mostly women. The city really had no way of taking care of women. They had no way. They sent them to the asylums where the food was assured by the state. And many women I know are still in the asylum from the 30s. They had no way to solve the problem. So there was a man named Papineau in California who wrote a book saying that, a serious book on unemployment, that the only solution to unemployment, if it would be nice if you could freeze workers and put them in a warehouse when you didn't need them, and then unfreeze them. This was a serious proposition, I think. And this was the only solution to unemployment, was sterilization of workers. Well, Hitler was just becoming known for sterilization of workers in Germany. So this began to be a great fight around. You could be picked up I was picked up in the bus station, for example, with a bunch of women. You go in there to get warm. It's very cold in Minnesota. You can't just romantically starve under bridges in Minnesota. You know, you can freeze in solid in 1 or 2 minutes. And so they'd pick us up in big nets, police women, for soliciting in bus stations. And within 24 hours, you could be sterilized. You could be sent to Faribault. You could be sterilized. We had very good laws against this in Minnesota. But who can invoke a law, a farm girl from the farm you didn't know anything about? You could invoke, you could get a lawyer if you could, and you could demand an intelligence test, and had lots of things, but you couldn't invoke them. You didn't know anything about them. So we begin to have this really fight. It's in the girl against sterilization. Not only of women, but radicals following Hitler's were often sterilized or tried to sterilize them. So the girl gets a job in a tavern. I was really surprised the other day reading my old notes that the two people in the tavern were actually named Hoink. I thought I made that up. But reality is so much better than you are. You know, that was their name, Hoink and Ack. and the woman's name was Belle. And the cat's name was Susie Belly. And that was really true. That was, you know, I was really surprised. I thought it was really part of my ingenious making up. But you can't get ahead of the true thing. So it begins with this farm girl getting a job in Hank and Oink's tavern. And so the whole thing takes place. What took place then also was the attempt to organize the unemployed. Two great organizations came out of it, the Workers' Alliance and the Unemployed Council. There was no structure in America to organize the unemployed. The trade unions didn't. Here you had millions thrown up from below, just thrown up and out into the, with no jobs and no social aid of any kind. It was really a terrible problem. So these two great organizations, somebody should make a study of them, because they were great democratic organizations of people, very often guided, and the main force, women workers. And I had my first experience in those on Hennepin and Washington. There was a big fancy store, food store. And there was a park there then, and all of us women with children, we were sort of sitting in this park. You ever be sort of sitting in a park, you know, with supper coming on and you having nothing to feed your children? And this big window was there, you know, with all this. I don't think we voted on it, I even spoke about it, but suddenly it seemed like we were all leaning against the glass of this store, and the glass kind of broke. And it seems like we all, and then a strange thing happened. I thought, well, now these women are just going to, you know, it's going to be a chaos. They're going to grab all the food. One of the women went up to the owner and said, "We're not thieves. We're very hungry, and we're going to put down everything that we take here, and we'll pay you back." Because nobody knew how long the depression was going to last. So that's what they did. And somebody was taking, and nobody voted for anybody, it seemed like. You know, they just were, and then there was a big woman came down with a whole bunch of sausages around her neck. I thought, well, now she's going to hoard all the sausages. I mean, I thought that was indigenous to women's structure. And instead of that, she asked who had the most children. And right there, she organized who had the most children got the most sausages. And some other women then joined her, and it was all organized. I mean, who got what? I got a dozen eggs and a pound of coffee, for example, which I wrote down. And it was all, till the store was empty. It was organized by these women. I've never seen an organization like that. So this story is really about the women organizing around to survive, a Workers' Alliance organization, and a birth. Now, the editor that was buying this story told me that was not true, that women never organized together, that they were natural enemies, that they were naturally competitive with each other, and that this was not true. He also told me that the bank robbery, this is a bank robbery, he also told me that the bank robbery was not true, and I was driving the bank car. And then he told me that I didn't know what it was to be a woman. And then he told me I should stop writing. I had no talent anyway. Now, he would never tell a young male writer this, I'm sure. He said, you just have no talent anyway. You better stop. Get a good job and raise your children. I couldn't believe that till I reread that. There's a good comment on that. This Bell. So I'm going to read sections of this, also about sexuality and about the feeling of women. So the story goes that she gets Butch, and her lover is in cahoots with a big small town racket, really a small town. St. Paul then was the northwest head of the criminal movement there, of the bootleg crowd, and so this guy, they got in with him who wants to rob the bank and is really only using them and really kills them in the end, really decides, he has a plot to take the money and kill Butch. And this is what really happens. But the story is the story of the girl falling in love with Butch and his life, which she knows nothing about. And the interchange between them of his, he's a baseball winning, going to win. He's going to get a service station. That was the dream of get a service station, and that was a hoax too, because they just used it. You know, you were put out. And one of the terrible moments is when after he's shot in the bank robbery, where he finds out that he really can't ever get a service station. He's not going to get anything that he thought of it. So in the meantime, of course, she's pregnant with a child, but she tries to get her to have an abortion. And then the women who are organizing the Workers' Alliance organize the child around to have the child, for the women to have the child collectively. That's getting to be really a popular thing now in the women's communes. I just love it. They, you know, have their own child. I was the father of one of these children. She was going to have an abortion, and we had this film collective. We persuaded her, let us all have a child. So I went to all the midwife exercises, you know, to perform the father's role. There was about three or four women did that. We were all prepared. So we had a collective baby, and I was supposed to hold the baby, you know, until she came out of the... It was not a natural birth. Anyway, I held the baby for 10 hours. It changed my whole life to look into this baby... eyes for 10 hours and hold her. And strangely enough, she took one look at me and went to sleep. And the whole hospital came down and said, you know, a baby like that sometimes cries for hours. They were going to put her in an incubator. He said she needs a heartbeat and a steady heat. I said, I have both of them. The tragedy was that we were the mothers for about 2 years, and then she got a good job in Los Angeles and they took our baby away from us. I have to follow her there and go see the baby every once in a while. So I'm going to start after the attempts to organize the Workers Alliance. The Butch is shot in the holdup, and she drives him. He's not apprehended for some strange reason, and she drives him away out of town. And this is while she's driving the car, he relives his whole life. You always mark these places, then you never can find them. Or you find it so interesting to read parts of it. So she's driving him in this old car. Out of town. Butch came backward out the bank door. I kept my eyes on him. He came out with his back to me, and he was holding his side. He was bent over, and then he straightened and turned toward me and ran 4 steps. People seemed to be running past him into the bank. No one seemed to be paying any attention to him. I raced the engine, and when he closed the door, I threw it in the shift, and grating it a little because my foot had gone to sleep, and Butch said, they're both dead. I didn't know who. I didn't ask him. I hoped it was Gans anyway. No one seemed to notice us. I drove down to the end of the street, turned down the river hill. I drove fast and over the bridge without thinking, because that was the way I was supposed to go. I know nobody was following us. I couldn't figure it. I didn't even try to figure it. I just drove as fast as I could, but not too fast. I took off my coat and put that on your side, I said, and try to stop the blood. Where are we going now, he said. It don't much matter now, does it? Go on, blame me. I got you into this. Go on and blame me. I can take it. Don't say anything, I said. It makes it worse. We were driving through the flatlands, and I hoped we were going south, and I tried to keep it to the little road so it wouldn't be seen. Well, you were right. Go on, tell me you were right. This is a fine end to come to. We aren't coming to an end, I said. He didn't say anything, and it scared me. We kept on driving, and after a while he said, we haven't got a bit of the haul. Nobody followed us, and we haven't a thing. After all that, and not a thing. That bastard Gans made it all up so he could carry the money. I could have just as well had a satchel, but he would carry the money. It could have been every man with a satchel and his chances. He seemed excited, and I couldn't keep him from talking, and I felt better now than I felt before the holdup. I felt light, as if I'd dropped about 100 pounds. He kept on talking. There was a short fellow at the bar, he said, in a black mackinaw. He had a pointed nose, and he was always having a fine time. He died of rot gut, but he had a good time. And he said, what kind of a cup is this? The Chalice of McCarthy. He was a card. That was McCarthy, a saloon. And he said, this is the Chalice of McCarthy. I'm going to wear a green tie, he said, and if I have to bust a gut, I won't buy beer for any sons of guns that are drunk. If you are sober, you need a beer. Oh, he was a card, all right. But if you are drunk, you don't need a beer. He was the greatest gambler in town. He used to gamble with Joe Hill, and he knew what it was all about, and he knew the cards were stacked. And he told me then, he said, Butch, the cards are marked. When I was just a punk, he told me that. But I was smart. I was too smart. I was pretty smart. There was no use to tell him to be quiet now. I had to find some place to take him. I thought, should I take him to a doctor? I was afraid to take him. It seemed like we were against everybody now. Now we haven't got a thing, Butch said. After all that and all that money in my hands, I can still feel it. What we could have done with even a little bit of that sweet money. You're alive, I said. He looked at me. I was thinking, he said, standing by them pillars before we went in. When that girl went by, there was a few seconds there. I could have walked out. We could have lived our lives like you wanted. I could have walked out of there right then. Don't talk, I said. I kept on driving through the country, going around the towns and villages. Nobody was coming after us now, and we must have been about 150 miles by afternoon, and the land was very flat, and I thought maybe we were in Iowa, and it seemed so flat I looked at the sun and turned east because I had a crazy idea we could drive into the dark quicker and maybe get into Missouri or some wooded country, and it was frightening to see it so flat and no place to go but into the ground. I kept driving, and nobody was coming after us. Farmers' wives came out and stood at the door, and we drove past like lovers. Butch looked all right from the chest up, and he leaned a little against me. And the women stood in the doors of their houses, and children looked out the windows. All wives are beautiful. I did everything just like we planned. Butch said, I couldn't catch hold of that fat bastard. He slipped out of my hands like a greased pig. He let out an awful squeal. I heard him, I said. Don't talk. I'm going to stop now and get some gas before it's dark. And sit up, I said, and pull that coat around. You don't think it was my fault, do you? Butch said, I mean the whole mess. No, I said, it wasn't your fault. You couldn't help it, any of it. Be still now. I drove into a service station. 5 gallons, I said. Could we fill our can, too? We are going camping. Sure, he said. Going south? Yes, I said. Maybe it's warm in Arkansas. I hoped we were going towards Arkansas. It didn't surprise him. Yes, he said. Good hunting down there, too. He took our can from the back seat, and it was a service station built like a cottage. Those were paper geraniums at the window. This is a swell place you got here, Butch said. The young man looked at us and went inside. How much money you got, Butch? I got a fiver. Gans gave me for gas, he said. Good, I said. That's one thing Gans did that, it was okay. And the young man came out, and Butch said again that it was a fine place he had. He looked at us. Oh, yes, he said, wiping the windshield. Butch and I leaned together so he wouldn't see. I put everything me and my wife had into this place, he said, and now Standard Oil's going to take it away from us. How can they do that? Butch said. Didn't you get a lease? Oh, sure, he said. That's a racket. They make you feel like you got your place, like you're going to be the boss, a big shot, and they take all your dough, and then they find got it fixed so you can't make good. You could work 28 hours out of 24, and you'd starve your wife and kids and throw them in with it. They got you milked from both ends. It's a racket. They hold the cards. You can't win. And when you give up, when they suck you dry, they get another sucker. Holy mackerel, Butch said. It was getting night, and he gave us the change, and when we drove on down the road, Butch began to swear. I never heard him swear like that. Oh, Butch, I said, don't. Oh, the goddamn bastards. You got you coming and going. They got you. Be quiet, I said. Just be quiet. I had to stop somewhere. It was getting dark. And once it began to snow a little, and I was disappointed. I thought we were going south. I hoped we were going south. I knew if we drove long enough, we would come to a river. And rivers always have dark places near them, caves and trees. Butch got very delirious. Yes, Butch said, honey, it's got to show pretty soon. Where are we going? It's got to show soon. What are we looking forward to? You've got to believe in the future. I knew a man, he wasn't my father, but he said, son, I can't tell you anything, but you'll find out something. You'll learn something. He wasn't my father, but he told me that. I wouldn't pay him no mind. I was a cocky buck. We were coming to some trees and rolling hills. It was nice to drive into them. No, he wasn't my father, but said, do I owe my father any grief? Answer me that, he said. You don't owe your father anything. Here we are kicked around all our lives, and what do you owe your father? Spawning you in it. He began to sing. It sounded terrible. I cried a little so he wouldn't know, and he began to sing like he was drunk to the tune of the Star-Spangled Banner. My father's gone to sea, of thee I sing. This is a dirty day, he said, a hell of a day. My mother, he said, she was the darndest baller out, and all those, Lord, there were kids everywhere, like a brood of chicks, and where are mine? Where's my son? He'd make the big team, wouldn't he? He wouldn't be a white feather. I gotta take the old carcass somewhere. I gotta sleep somewhere. Don't worry about it. I can sleep anywhere. I'm pretty sleepy. Hell, nobody'll bother you. One summer I slept in the morgue every night. Now that's a good place to sleep. Joe at the morgue don't like you to stay alone with all the stiffs, and it's cold in summer. It's about the coolest place in summer. And you crawl up a nice, cool slab. Joe was good shake.